It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Excuse me.
I should warn you that I'm kind of sick this morning, so I'll try not to get anything on the microphone. But
okay, that'd be great.
That's good. Thanks for the warning, John.
Sure.
You should have told us a little earlier. We would have placed you one seat over. Special child seat. All right.
Over in the corner over there.
Can I sit on telephone books while I'm at it?
Yeah, we'll have something for you.
We'll find a booster chair for you.
So let's dive into this week's stuff. The Seattle School.
Oh, do we want to talk about getting questions?
Oh, we'll take, if we have time at the end, we'll take a question or two, short question or two via email, which you can send in at dj@kexp.org. So, Seattle Schools had a shift in directions this week. Wants to talk about that.
Yeah, they certainly did. Raj Manas, who is the architect of the plan to close 10 schools, 8 elementary and then a middle school, and to shift some popular alternative programs, backed down. And he backed down in the face of not only well-organized parental opposition, but also some tremendous political opposition from Greg Nichols and County Councilor Ron Sims and several members of the school board. The big question now is what's next? If you take school closures off the table, and school closures would not have saved that much money. There's a $20 million shortfall expected for the year 2006-2007, and the school closures would only have bridged a couple $3 million out of that. So there's still a tremendous shortfall to be bridged. Now they're going, and there was also a backing down in the part of the plan whereby they were going to eliminate the cluster. The crosstown busing for non-special needs students, where they were going to change the formula by which students are assigned to schools. That is still in place, but it won't be applied to students until new students for the schools that they're in. Students who are now in a school will be permitted to finish out going to the school. So if they're in 10th grade now, they'll be permitted to go to that school all the way through graduation.
So the cost savings is going to be limited.
So the cost savings for that will be limited as well. Mm-hmm. So the question then becomes, what on earth do you do to bridge the gap? And probably you're looking at teacher layoffs. There's really almost nothing. There's no single source that can save that kind of money. But it's very, very clear at this point that regardless of what happens, if you take school closures off the table, it's going to come out of the classroom. It's going to affect students in a very direct and very palpable way. And this was the bargain when parents lobbied to keep their schools open. This is what the alternative is. And so we're gonna see now a special committee being formed by people from city council and various leadership councils in the city, as well as the school board and the school district, to try and figure out where the cost savings can come from. If you remember, before there was a plan that was being muttered about in the dark corridors of power to have the city take over the school district. That may not be off the table. That may be coming also. So keep an ear peeled for that. But the question right now is where the cost savings is going to come from, and there are no easy and there are no good answers.
Well, I was pretty sure I saw an article in the paper this week about that there were some layoffs or some firings at Seattle schools. Did anybody else catch that? Am I the only one that saw that?
I didn't.
Okay.
What I did see was an article in the PI talking about, or maybe it was in the Times, talking about how these school closures had been linked to the teachers' contract because the teachers had negotiated a better contract. It was more expensive, and hence it contributed to the shortfall. However, the Seattle Times didn't make a great case for that argument. And of course, they used that to go on to say, well, teacher firings are necessary. But I don't know that they made such a great case for that.
Yeah.
And we'll see.
I could swear I saw something that said about 170-some employees were getting cut loose, but could be wrong about that. Well, jumping over across the mountains to Hanford, there was a important case that that's been going on for weeks that finalized this week.
Yeah, the Downwinders, who actually this is a case that's been going on for years. Downwinders that sued the contractors for for Hanford, although the contractor's legal fees are all being paid for by the U.S. government, and the settlement costs will be paid for by the U.S. government. What happened was that the downwinders took their six best cases of three people who were affected by thyroid cancer and three more who were affected by autoimmune disease problems, and tried to prove that this was caused by releases of radiation in Hanford, downwind from the Hanford plant in the 40s and 50s. This was a case that had been watched very closely because the U.S. government has steadfastly denied, and the courts thus far have steadfastly denied, any health effects from Hanford and the downwinders. And lo and behold, they got a mixed decision. They did get the first precedent of having downwinders cases be found liable to the U.S. government. Two of the thyroid cancer cases were found liable, although the settlement awards were much less than the actual cost of the legal fees. They were in the neighborhood of $200,000-$300,000. And then a third case went to a hung jury, which means that she can refile her claim. The three autoimmune cases did not succeed. The science on that has since become clearer since the evidence was given in that case originally. So for subsequent cases, that they may fare better. But the defense, oddly enough, was painting this as a victory, saying that this was the best shot, that these were handpicked cases, that that they were unlikely to succeed in the future. But it does set a precedent. It sets a precedent of saying that the release of plutonium at Hanford did cause health problems for people, and this is something that the U.S. government needs to be held liable for.
Mm. And it's always interesting that it's the taxpayers that end up picking up the tab for the defense contractors' legal fees.
Yeah, that the defense contractors wind up getting scot-free on this. They don't pay anything, and taxpayers wind up footing the bill.
All right. Well, moving along, speaking of bills, there's a highway bill in the Senate.
Yeah, actually, the highway bill was passed by the Senate this week. And it's approximately $295 billion, about $11 billion higher than the House version. Now, the Bush administration has said that they will veto the highway bill if it comes to the president's desk for $295 billion. They want it to be $11 billion less. There's some differences between the Senate bill and the House bill. This transportation package in the House includes all of these little pork projects. Now, the transportation bill passed by the Senate will actually fund some needed highway changes, even though it's more expensive. So when they sit down to reconcile the two bills, it'll be interesting to see what actually survives the reconciliation process and what gets sent to George Bush's desk.
I love the smell of bacon in the morning.
Now, there's a couple of interesting things, too, about this highway bill. First of all, it should have been passed last year. The Bush administration threatened to veto last year's bill because it was too expensive. And in the meantime, no highway construction has been done. No federal money has been meted out for any kind of highway improvements in the last 18 months, waiting for a bill to pass. If this one gets vetoed, it's going to be a whole nother year before we see a new one. That's another year lost for highway improvements. Now, the other interesting thing about this bill is the local angle. Nichols, the downtown Seattle folks, Mayor Greg Nichols, was hoping that the bill would include money for the Alaskan Way Viaduct. He was looking for at least $1 billion, and this bill does not include any money for the Alaskan Way Viaduct. I think it's a sign that we're not going to see the kind of funds that local planners are estimating we're going to be able to find from the feds for these major highway construction projects like 520, the Alaskan Way Viaduct, needed improvements on I-5. That money's just not coming from the feds. It really is showing you what the Bush administration's priorities are and the Republican Party, the Republican majority in the House. Their priorities are not to fund needed infrastructure here at home. It's to throw money down the Iraq War money pit.
Well, they're also not to fund. They're also not to fund needed infrastructure in states with Democratic senators. This is something where Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray tried to lobby for the Alaskan Way Viaduct, and they were unsuccessful.
Yeah, that's true. So that's what we're looking at too. in this bill is that when you don't have the, when you're not a part of the Republican majority in the House and Senate, you're out in the cold. You know, there is no kind of goodwill at all anymore in the House and Senate between the two parties. But, you know, as Jav was saying earlier, he said he didn't understand why these Republicans love to drive their SUVs but aren't willing to pay for highway improvements.
Yeah, and we see this also locally with the initiative that John Carlson and Kirby Wilbur are mounting at KVI to repeal the gas tax. I mean, this is something where this was the one solution that's come down the pike for building freeways, for expanding 520, expanding the 405, and repairing the Alaska Way Viaduct. And it's something that everybody agrees needs to happen, and yet for some reason they just find the idea of paying for it too onerous.
Yeah, it's this idea that driving is free. As long as I buy my car, I don't have to shell out any more money except to maintain my car. I don't have to shell out any money to maintain or build or pay for improvements to the roads that I drive on. I mean, that's insane.
And heaven forbid if the license tabs cost more than $30.
Yeah.
Well, we were going to do it at the end of the show, but since we got an email in that is still addressing this subject, why not fund the schools? Could we rescind the Democratic lead Boeing tax breaks of 2003 and fund the schools through the legislature?
Oh, yeah. I think that would be a good idea. This last legislative session didn't see any repeal of any of the multiple tax breaks that the state gives to big business and small businesses as well, but big business in particular, and Boeing a prime example. You know, the legislature could sit down and actually review some of those tax breaks and ask the question, are these good for the state, not just good for the business that's getting the break? And if they repealed some of those tax breaks, like the credit for airline fuel in this state, which costs the state a lot of money, I mean, they could actually close some of the budget gap and maybe have some left over to fund things like the Seattle school shortfall, put more money into raising teachers' salaries and funding things like replacing the Alaskan Way Viaduct.
Yeah, and if you talk to school board members or people affiliated with a school district, they will tell you that the funding that comes from the state for the school district is absolutely pitiful, that they desperately need more money from the state, and it has not been forthcoming. So, yeah, that would be an excellent solution.
All right, moving along, the Senate Intelligence Committee is looking at ratcheting down some more or opening up, at least to the FBI, some more powers.
Yeah, the Senate Intelligence Committee is having a hearing next Thursday, and of course, they haven't announced any of this publicly. It's been leaked to the New York Times that there are at least a couple of fairly controversial proposals on the table for expanding the USA Patriot Act. One of them involves mail powers, that the FBI would have the ability, without any judicial review and without the review of the Postal Service, to issue something called a cover on a person's mail so that they would get the names and addresses and various details of any mail coming to or from persons of interest in terrorism investigations. That's one area of vast expansion of power. The other is in the area of business records, and this is something that they've been nibbling at for a while, that they would be able, anything more than the say-so of the investigators, that this had a relationship to a terrorism investigation, no judicial review would be necessary, that they would be able to go after receipts, they would be able to go after bank records, they would be able to go after any kind of records of businesses that they suspect have anything to do with a terrorism investigation. The ACLU and various civil liberties groups are really very upset about both of these provisions. They come directly from the White House. They're supported by the Republican majority on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and they stand a very good chance, even as Democrats are trying to pare back the USA Patriot Act, they stand a very good chance of being pushed through.
What I found interesting about that was that at the same time that they're discussing that particular expansion, they were also looking at the FBI was before the, I believe it was the Senate this week, talking about environmental groups, ELF, ALF, being, you know, the top terrorist groups in the country, and that they wanted to...
That's preposterous.
They wanted to go into the financial records of major environmental groups that seem to be supporting these ELF, ALF, potentially financially. So,
yeah, and by supporting, they mean that, that somebody on Greenpeace's mailing list may also be, you know, suspected of being affiliated with ALF or something.
Or if you just talk about the same topic with your environmental group, regardless of who you are, if you're the Sierra Club, if you're Greenpeace.
We've seen this, for example, in the whole scandal around the FBI harassment of peace groups and environmental groups in the Denver area, where they were making massive leaps of faith in terms of who was connected with whom and who was cause and effect in terms of people who might be possibly committing civil disobedience. This had to do with the political conventions last summer and people who might be going to attend that versus people who might be planning to commit terrorist acts at the conventions. And really all it took to get on the FBI's shit list was waving a placard at a demonstration and saying that you plan to go to New York or Boston. So the standards of evidence for getting on the FBI's list for these things is very, very thin. And it's a really, really slippery slope that there's very little recourse for once you're there.
Yeah, and I find it interesting that the FBI is mounting all these resources to go after the ELF and the ALF when, in fact, the Bush administration is still saying that, you know, we have this fear of foreign terrorists, and occasionally they come out with these kind of knee-jerk announcements about, oh, Al-Qaeda could still target us on U.S. soil, et cetera. It's an admission, really, that the U.S. is not as vulnerable as the Bush administration is saying. At the same time, we are vulnerable in other ways that the Bush administration is not paying attention to. For example, our ports are still not very secure. As far as shipping in dangerous cargo or shipping in contraband, or in the case of this week, allowing terrorists that the CIA funded and supported, like this Posada person, which folks maybe have seen.
Yeah, Counterspin mentioned that.
Yeah, maybe have seen some newspaper articles or heard a little bit about this Posada person coming into the U.S. and trying to seek asylum here, when here's someone who is an international terrorist, has been responsible for the bombing of airliners and for attacks against civilians in Central America and done some pretty horrible things.
Yeah, when you consider how common human trafficking and illegal immigration is, how difficult is it for Al-Qaeda cell members or somebody like that to actually get into the United States? It's not that difficult. There is still vulnerability that the Bush administration would just prefer not to talk about.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to international and This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
The big news this week is that Operation Matador, the U.S. Marine offensive that took place near the Syrian border last week, turned out to be a major disaster in ways that were not reported by the U.S. media. It's a disaster akin to the destruction of Fallujah last year. Dar Jamail and some other Iraqi reporters, however, have been interviewing doctors, refugees, and NGOs, people who work for non-governmental aid organizations who are trying to provide help to the residents of the town of Qaim and other surrounding towns. U.S. forces, it turns out, are still surrounding the town of Qaim, which they were not able to actually enter because of the fighting. Water and electricity were cut off. The center of the city has been entirely destroyed, according to people who have fled the city. In addition, the hospital was bombed, they said, by U.S. aircraft. 12,000 Iraqis left the city, but many are still trapped inside. Many women, children, and elderly people were killed in the attack. Many are still injured. Both the living and the wounded are without food, water, or medical treatment. And NGOs and aid groups have not been able to get ambulances through the blockade and are having a difficult time getting materials to that region, because the U.S. military is still doing maneuvers in that area. The U.S. extensively used helicopter gunships in the city, and they just targeted people without knowing whether or not they were actually fighting the U.S. military. A lot of the bodies being collected have evidence of multiple gunshot wounds and of helicopter gunfire. Hopefully, there will be some lifting of the U.S. cordon around the city so that aid groups can get through. Meanwhile, U.S. Marines admitted this week that the militarily the maneuvers were a disaster. The U.S. Marines were not able to guard the border while they were fighting the insurgents, and so many of the guerrillas, I should call them, many of the guerrillas slipped across the border into Syria to avoid fighting the U.S., those that did not want to stand and fight, and those that did stand and fight inflicted pretty heavy casualties on the U.S. Marines that they did not expect. So there weren't as many insurgents captured or killed as the U.S. military wanted, and it did turn out to be just an exercise in futility. At the same time, it destroyed the city of Qaim and at least three other surrounding towns. Now, another thing that's kind of interesting about this is that the U.S. military had to admit that most of the guerrilla and foreign fighters that they have seen in Iraq are not from Syria. They are actually Saudis, according to terrorism experts who track the websites that post the list of the Iraqi so-called martyrs, those folks who do suicide bombings and who travel into Iraq to fight the U.S. military. Turns out they are from Saudi Arabia. So much for the Syria-Iran theory that the Bush administration proposes. You might ask the question, why Saudis? Well, it's because the Sunni majority in Saudi Arabia are a little bit nervous about the U.S.-imposed government and its connections to Iran and the returning exiles in the new Iraqi government that want to turn Iraq into a Shiite Muslim state. So that shouldn't be surprised by anybody. But we should be hearing more from the Bush administration about why doesn't Saudi Arabia guard their borders and keep Saudis from slipping into Iraq. In the meantime, there's been a lot of news this week and last week about potential civil war in Iraq. The U.S. press is absolutely obsessed by it. There are certain sectarian groups in Iraq who are battling with words and sometimes guns, assassinating each other's members, and they seem to want sectarian violence in Iraq. However, there's the vast majority of Iraqis who are used to secular politics. Iraq has a long history of secular politics, and there's much intermarriage between Sunnis, Shiites, Turkmen, Christians, you name it. And the vast majority of Iraqis are not interested in sectarian violence, and when they're interviewed by U.S. reporters, usually their quotes are kind of shoehorned in at the very end of the article, they often say, we don't pay attention to these guys. They're just having their feuds, and we're more interested in the U.S. pulling out and a real representative government being put in place. That really, it turns out, is the crux of the civil war. There is a civil war going on in Iraq. That civil war, however, is between people who want a grassroots self-government, government that is truly representative of the people, and those who want to impose these returning exiles from abroad and create a government that is closer to the United States than to anyone in Iraq or anyone of its neighbors. So I want to leave folks with that thought. When you see articles that talk about civil war, remember the civil war is between the returning exiles who want to impose a certain style of rule on the Iraqi people and the Iraqi people who pretty much want something different. And you see evidence of that with both Shiites and Sunnis protesting for U.S. withdrawal, who are also against the new government of Iraq. We had both Muqtada al-Sadr, a Shiite, and his supporters. He has a lot of grassroots support throughout Baghdad and region south of Baghdad protesting for U.S. withdrawal this week. And you see it obviously in the guerrilla movement that is predominantly Sunni. So that wraps up this week in Iraq. Although I would like to talk for a few minutes about George Galloway and his being called before a U.S. Senate committee on the oil for food probe. He actually said to the chairman, look, who is this senior official in Baghdad who is giving you all this evidence on the oil for food program and telling you who the people are that are receiving money, who received money from Saddam Hussein? Because Galloway himself has obviously not received any money, and he has provided evidence of that. Well, the lead senator of the investigation, Norm Coleman, wouldn't announce who that senior Iraqi official is, but I can tell you who it was. It's Ahmed Chalabi. He boasted right after the U.S. invasion that he had found among what he called Saddam Hussein's governmental papers, he found evidence that would implicate all of these politicians in an oil for food scandal, and he gave a lot of that information to right-wing Republican senators. He, we should remember, was the source of a lot of the false information that the Bush administration had about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He also told, pretty much told Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, and Condoleezza Rice that if you invade Iraq, the Iraqi people will welcome you with open arms, and that didn't happen. So I think at this point we ought to say anything that anyone gets from Ahmed Chalabi should be highly suspect. George Galloway was saying that when he demanded to know who the senior Baghdad official is. And I think this whole oil for food program scandal is really a red herring. It draws our attention away from what the Senate should be investigating, which is how the U.S. government and the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority, run by Paul Bremer, mismanage Iraqi funds and U.S. taxpayer money and have, I think, pocketed quite a bit of the money that should have been spent on reconstruction.
All right. Very quickly, yesterday, military recruiters had a day off of sorts.
Yeah, I hope everybody enjoyed the fact that you weren't getting hit by military recruiters yesterday. But, you know, a lot of folks were wondering, you know, how come this day off for military recruiters, other than that military recruiting is pretty obnoxious? Well, you had recruiters doing things like signing up people who were mentally ill. They were helping people who didn't have a high school education fake their transcripts. They were doing things like taking guys to the drugstore to find diuretics for them so they could get traces of illicit drugs out of their system before they took the physicals. They're doing all kinds of things like lying to students, telling them they wouldn't have to go to Iraq, that sort of thing. So military recruiters will be back up and operating again on Monday, but folks should keep that in mind when you or your kid is approached by a military recruiter, and just ask them about it.
All right. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat This State.
Can I insert something in very quickly? Mm-hmm. On the Newsweek Quran scandal, there's a very good report on a blog called the Booman Tribune, BOOMANTribune.com, that lists something like 13 different sources of reports of Quran desecration, you know, stomping on, urinating on, and flushing down the toilet and various other things that appeared before the Newsweek approached it. So the Newsweek retraction is beside the point. This was a factual allegation that was already out there, and there's a reason that the retraction won't work because it won't be believed by Muslims.
Yeah.
The allegations are true.
Yeah, the allegations have come from multiple sources. They've been widely published, and I don't understand why Newsweek retracted them other than that they were afraid of the Bush administration lawyers. And I also want to mention, too, we are beginning our fund drive for Eat the State. We do this biannually, and we're hoping folks will support us. We want to go from 10 pages to 12 pages.
Eight pages to 12 pages.
We've gotten a lot of material in that we want to publish and bring to you every other week, and hopefully we can.
That we haven't been able to publish so far, but we would like to.
Yeah, we would like to. And so we would like to see folks give us some donations. You can go to our website at www.eatthestate.org, or you can send checks, either subscription renewals or checks for donations to our P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box
85541.
Seattle, Washington.
98145.
Thank you, Job. That's also how you can
again,
get a hold of us, and that's where you can find our newspaper as
again,
well.
Again, it's P.O. Box 85541, Seattle 98145.